Okay, any preliminary questions? Thanks for those of you who switched from the 11 o'clock section to accommodate the high school students this morning. Well, we left off yesterday having just kind of addressed the issue in Dillon versus Legg, opening up this kind of Pandora's box, as it were, trying to decide what kinds of cases we're going to entertain, which plaintiffs are eligible to ask a jury for compensation, and which plaintiffs are told, in effect, I'm sorry, you don't meet the criteria, your injury is not worth compensating. One of the things I want to emphasize as we start Hagel versus McMahon is the jurisdictional differences. That is, from state to state, you will have different formulas for what is or is not compensable, what kinds of plaintiffs are eligible. As I said earlier, the standard in Dillon versus Legg is often referred to as it is by the Washington court, not as binding precedent, but rather as a kind of outline of the issues. But once the issues are outlined, the individual state is free, obviously by way of legislation, but also by way of court decision, to say, well, we're going to tweak it a little bit here and we're going to modify it a little bit there. And so, again, Hagel versus McMahon is our chance to watch the way in which, relatively recently, 5 years ago, the court was processing cases in which it was not clear to the trial judge whether or not the plaintiffs were or were not entitled to a recovery. And then after we do Hagel, we'll spend a little time on Rodriguez. So, Hagel, anybody want to tell us about, not the dialectic, not that Hagel, but this one. Somebody wants to tell us about Georg Friedrich Hegel, that's fine too. Mr. LeBanc. Okay, so the trial judge in the Hagel case said, I'm sorry, you simply don't fit the criteria that we have established for claims like this. There's a companion case, and similar to this Filippides case I mentioned before, where there are actually four different cases consolidated into one hearing and one appellate case. Here there are two cases consolidated together to decide a common issue. What's the fact pattern in the second case? Yeah. So again, this sort of gruesome, grisly scene, the kind of thing that would generate these intrusive memories, post-traumatic stress disorder, and the like. Okay. And what happens when the father brings the claim for his witnessing of this accident? Why? What's missing here? Okay, so like the previous case, we have to decide when Dillon versus Legg talks about the importance of being present at the accident scene, does that mean at the moment the car strikes the victim's body? Or is it sufficient, as the plaintiffs argue in this case, that they arrive sufficiently soon after the accident takes place that they witness the gore, the mayhem, the carnage, and are traumatized by those visual images? Okay. Now, the defendants point to a previous case in Washington that appears to impose a requirement that the plaintiffs actually be at the accident scene at the time the injury takes place. And what case is that? Actually, Hunsley is the case where the car goes into the plaintiff's bedroom or living room, and the plaintiff's claiming emotional distress, again, not because it gruesomely injures somebody closely related to the plaintiff, but is simply, that would be, Hunsley is actually more like the Johnson versus State of New York or the Steinhauser case where nobody's physically injured, but the plaintiff suffers this terrible emotional shock. But there's a previous case in Washington involving someone who says, you caused this gruesome injury to somebody near and dear to me, and I want to recover for it even though I wasn't actually there. Okay, what's Cunningham about? Okay. In Cunningham, the children... Yeah, Mr. Brown? Yeah. The Supreme Court case, Cunningham is a case decided by the Court of Appeals, but there is a case decided by the Washington Supreme Court, Gain versus Carroll Mills, that says... what happens in Gain... That's the state trooper case. I may have already mentioned that one, where the father and the brother of the state trooper are watching the case on TV, the newscast describes how this trooper was fatally injured. They're watching in horror as the they're being told in effect, and they claim in effect, they say, hey, we were virtually there, and the court says, no, sorry, you weren't there, you recover nothing for this alleged bystander claim. Notice that it's different from a wrongful death claim. The father and the brother may be entitled in Gain versus Carroll Mill to a recovery for wrongful death, depending on whether they fall within the statutory list of beneficiaries. But if they're claiming this independent cause of action, like Dillon versus Legg, the court says, sorry, that doesn't apply to you because you weren't at the accident scene. What does the court say with respect to these two plaintiffs, or these two sets of plaintiffs, I should say? No, or fast-forwarding here to saying, again, the defendant's going to ask the court to say, Gain versus Carroll Mills covers our case. Ah, they add this little phrase, or arrive shortly thereafter, which, now is that found in Gain?
No.
Gain does actually say that, so that rather than citing Gain to say you have to be there when the accident takes place, Gain seems to acknowledge that you can recover if you arrive shortly thereafter. Now, again, whether or not you want to apply that rule is a matter of, in effect, public policy and jurisdictional preference. Some jurisdictions may want to err on the side of generosity. Some may want a nice, clear, bright line that unless you were physically there and actually watched the accident take place, you're not eligible to recover as a bystander. But the court says, based on what it says in Gain versus Carroll Mills, we have a more liberal rule, more generous rule. Now, there's another question in both of these cases about whether or not the plaintiffs have established the threshold requirements to be able to state a claim for a bystander injury. The defendants also claim, in effect, that you can't recover even if you're present at the accident scene unless Ms. Anderson. Okay, so this idea of being at the accident scene, not necessarily to observe the thing, but at least you suffer from the thing that makes it traumatic, the graphic nature of the injury. For those of us who are don't have a strong stomach, who are kind of queasy when we see things. I don't like to see, you know, much of any kind of blood or, you know, that kind of freaks me out. That's what we're worried about. So if I get to the accident scene, and even though this guy has suffered this terrible injury, in fact, you know, his leg has been severed, if by the time I get there they've wrapped him up in a blanket, you know, and his head is bruised and bloody, but blankets covering all the gore, and he's being put into the ambulance at that point, that's a substantial change. What we're looking for in terms of at the accident scene, arriving at the time of the accident or shortly thereafter, is I've got the kind of experience of seeing this severed limb or this, you know, gaping wound or the, you know, geyser of, you know, blood from a punctured artery. That's the kind of thing that generates a post-traumatic stress disorder rather than the fact of injury, which I might just as well have found out at the hospital or over the telephone. Okay, so again, identifying exactly how close to actually observing the accident you have to be and still be able to recover, or how distant you can be and still recover, that's one phenomenon. There's another issue the court's concerned about. Mr. Viviano. Well, that's actually the defendant's claim, that the defendant says unless you physically manifest it, and again this goes back to the discussion we had in Johnson versus State of New York or those kinds of cases, what would count as a physical injury or a physical manifestation? if, for example, I've been through a very traumatic experience, my baseball team lost the game in the last two innings, and I come in the next day looking haggard and worn and distraught, I may physically manifest that injury, that emotional injury, but again, we learn to read other people's emotions by watching their body language, and if we know them well, we can see by the way they appear whether they're in a good mood or not. Physical manifestation may not be the standard that we want. There's an alternative proposed by the court here as to what we would use as the deciding point. Yeah. What's objective symptomology? Okay, so we're looking, first of all, for medical, some sort of professional evaluation of the plaintiff. If, for example, I suffer emotional trauma because I observe an accident in the parking lot, and I have all of you testify that you have seen me and I display these symptoms of even more bizarre behavior than normal, so forth and so on, that doesn't do me any good, no matter how extensive. You're all, none of you are medical professionals. Some of you may be medical professionals, but unless you're testifying in that capacity, giving medical evaluation. So what would a plaintiff need to qualify under that standard? Like who? Psychiatrist or a psychologist, therapist of some kind? And remember that the definition of psychological illness is fairly broad, so that I don't know if you studied the Hinckley case, U.S. versus Hinckley in criminal law, that John Hinckley, who shot the president and James Brady, he was diagnosed with narcissistic personality disorder. The psychiatrist explained that, unlike normal people who have some concept that if I shoot at you, that's a bad thing because you have as much a right not to be shot as I do, and sort of a kind of a if not the golden rule, at least the silver rule, I restrain myself from doing something to you that I would not want done to myself. But a person suffering from a narcissistic personality disorder like John Hinckley can only think about himself. He imagines that he's going to impress Jodie Foster with this historic act, and that she will know his great love for her, because he was willing to do this thing which would probably get himself killed, but that was far more important to him than whatever consequences there were for the president or for James Brady or for anybody else. Well, gee, when I start to think of the people that suffer from a narcissistic personality disorder, that's a pretty long list. So to the extent that you ask for a medical diagnosis as a precondition for claiming emotional distress, it's more of a bureaucratic process you have to go through rather than actually, if you can't find a psychologist or a psychiatrist who will classify what ails you in terms of some diagnostic category, you haven't looked very hard. There's somebody out there who will provide that kind of testimony. So again, while we are insisting upon a measure of of objective medical symptomology before we allow people to state a claim like this, it's not a very significant hurdle. We're simply translating the kind of lay opinion that you and I would have, where you could testify, gee, before this accident, DeWolf was able to do these various things, and after the accident, it seemed like his whole life fell apart, and stuff was really hard for him, and he couldn't concentrate, and he was a wreck. That's not good enough. We need to have that opinion delivered by a psychologist who will give it a label, provide a diagnosis, and so forth. Yeah. Well, remember that our first assignment here is to figure out, does the plaintiff get their day in court? In both of these cases, the trial judge said, no, go home. You don't get to tell your story to the jury because you haven't fulfilled the threshold criteria to even play the game. You're not on the guest list here. Whereas once the court has set these standards that say if you're either you observe the accident or you arrive sufficiently soon thereafter that the things that cause emotional distress are pretty much still there. They haven't gotten the victim covered up with blankets and put into an ambulance. Well, that's one thing. And in addition, if you can provide evidence of medical symptomology, then you'll get your day in court. And at that point, your testimony is just like everything else. Some witnesses will say this kid was going to be a basketball player to rival whoever, Roni Turioff or Dan Dickow, and other witnesses will say, no, not so. And again, what the plaintiff is asking for is not decide my case as a matter of law today. The plaintiff is saying, let me play this game. Don't freeze me out because you're afraid that maybe somebody like me wouldn't necessarily have a meritorious claim. So again, this is one court's the latest statement as of the time you read this opinion, and since this opinion, there are other cases that tweak it and adjust it here and there, provide new insights, new precedents where the court said yes or said no to a particular case. But for purposes of the exam, what you have, in effect, is, I don't know what jurisdiction I'm in. I don't know whether my jurisdiction has adopted a more liberal test that essentially says we're going to interpret these rules broadly so that more people get their day in court, or whether we're in a jurisdiction that is afraid of overextending these rules and sets up tighter boundaries and says, unless you meet this criterion, no matter how well you're doing on these other criteria, you don't get to play the game. And so you're not typically in a position where you can say with much confidence, except at the extremes. At the extremes, you can safely predict, well, gee, I can't imagine any jurisdiction that would entertain a case based on these facts, or I would expect that virtually every jurisdiction would say this plaintiff is entitled to a recovery for a bystander injury. But to the extent you have one that's more in the middle, you're conflicted. A couple of years ago, for example, I gave an exam in which the facts of the case were these. She was 17 years old, high school student, who worked on her uncle's farm after school, he asks her to some kind of wheat seed or something like that, run it through this sifting device or a sorter or some kind of big machine. And so she's taking these sacks of seed and pouring them in, and as she does so, her sleeve is caught by the feeding mechanism, and it sucks her hand in, and it's all mangled by this machine. She calls her boyfriend, says, "Help, you know." He comes, he bandages up her mangled hand and drives her to the hospital, and she's got, you know, permanent injuries to her hand. One of the questions in the exam is, I don't pose this as a question, but one of the issues that you would want to consider in evaluating what sort of tort claims would arise out of this fact pattern would be, does the boyfriend have a claim for negligently inflicted emotional distress? Is he a bystander? As it turns out, they later marry. By the time the case is ready to go to trial, they are married. How would you go about evaluating that claim? Okay, and if you didn't know what jurisdiction you were in, what would be your general sense as to whether or not that case is likely to produce a recovery or unlikely? What criteria would you consider? Okay, why? Okay, he arrives at the accident scene before the... In fact, he's involved in helping to deal with the injury. Mr. Brown? Yeah, so again, what I would do with it is to run it through the Dillon criteria. It's not so good at the scene of the accident. The direct emotional shock, I'm sure if you see, you know, the tendons exposed and the bones are broken, and, you know, that's gross. But it's you know, it's not like somebody's been decapitated or, you know, limbs are in, you know, whatever. As you point out, although they later get married, at the time they're neither related legally or related by blood. So I wouldn't put a whole lot of money on his being successful in recovering something under those facts. Now maybe it gets worse. Maybe there's more to these facts. That the wound is actually, you know, horribly graphic and maybe he's got these huge psychologist bills, you know, he had a promising engineering career, but after this accident the best he can do is sit around and do crossword puzzles all day. Maybe there's more to this that's gonna give it a greater punch. But simply giving you the facts that I gave you, I'd say don't bet the farm on this one, so to speak. Yeah. Right. So there is this thing called survivor guilt and so forth, where people who, for example, on a plane crash, you know, the guy next to me gets killed and I walk away, you know, I suffer from the fact that, gee, it seems kind of unfair that, you know, and maybe I asked to switch seats with him or something. You know, I wanted an aisle seat or a window seat, and so he switched me and, you know. But again, although you can imagine things that might get you someplace, if you had to guess about the likelihood that it's going to go anywhere, I wouldn't be very sanguine, so to speak. Okay. Now, we shift at this point on page 97 here to a different kind of claim. Marianne Rodriguez is not at the accident scene. She can't claim damages from watching her husband suffer some gruesome, gory injury, but she has a different basis for saying, I deserve a recovery. Now, what's partly confusing about this whole line of cases is that while we can distinguish one type of case from another, remember my distinction between what I would call a direct injury, as in Steinhauser or Johnson versus State of New York, as opposed to a derivative injury, where someone else suffers a physical injury and I'm deriving my claim as a spin-off of that, the courts cite the same cases as though they were all kind of interchangeable. So Hunsley versus Giard, where the car winds up in the plaintiff's living room, is a case cited as the basis of authority for saying we permit recovery for negligently inflicted emotional distress, but that's cited in a case involving a derivative injury where you watch your loved one get badly hurt. Here, again, in Rodriguez, Marianne's claiming damages because the 600-pound pipe was, in effect, dropped on their marriage, and she's a part of that marriage, and she wants her damages flowing from that. But the cases that they cite, in part, are Dillon versus Light. And you could say, oh, there's a whole different body of law that deals with bystander injuries as distinguished from consortium injuries, but it doesn't work like that. They're all kind of muddled together. Now, in turn, Rodriguez, let's just follow this out here. Can somebody tell us about Marianne and Richard and the 600-pound pipe? Go ahead. Ms. Wisely. Okay. Now, what's the plaintiff's primary obstacle in seeking legal compensation for her injury? Well, that would have qualified her for a bystander injury, but if she's ever going to get a recovery for this loss of consortium claim, not for witnessing it, but for being related. True, but there just playing my little fishing game here. The problem she's got is there's a previous case directly on point, is there not? And let's talk about that case and what we're going to do with it. What's the case? Yeah, I don't know how to pronounce it. Anybody know anybody by that name? It looks like sort of a French name. Desitel, or whatever. Okay. the D case anyway. So what did that case say? I mean, just the bottom line in the case for purposes of this discussion. Right. Okay, before we get to the rationale, though, just the bottom line is, in California, we do not recognize a claim for loss of consortium. And so if the court's going to provide her with the recovery, we have to deconstruct that case. We have to explain why we're not governed by the rule of stare decisis, remembering that we have this legal principle that says ordinarily we let the decision stand. Even if we happen to disagree with it, part of the consistency and predictability of the law is the assumption that once a case has been decided, future cases will in effect honor that precedent until it's changed by some statute or constitutional amendment or whatever it takes to change the rule. But obviously there are times when the court believes that a case no longer deserves to be followed, that the decision shouldn't stand, that the decision should be overruled. And just in general, if you're a judge and you are contemplating overruling a case rather than following it, what do you need to do to have a good reason not to follow this Desitel case? Why not? What kinds of things would do that? The rationale that supported that previous case no longer persuades us. And as you point out, the rationale may have lost its persuasive power because things that were believed then are no longer believed today. Or rules, as Judge Cardozo later says in a product liability case, rules made in the days of travel by horse and buggy don't necessarily fit a society where people drive automobiles. Okay, so let's look at the rationale for the Desitel case and see if any of these rationales, the justification for it, and see if any of those still persuade us. Okay, and in fact, let's just talk about this. It's an indirect harm, so that she wouldn't be injured except that Richard is injured. It's hard to exactly understand that. Obviously, in one sense, it's true that if you hadn't harmed Richard, she wouldn't be suffering this injury. But by the same token, you could say, well, if we fully compensated Richard, would she be free of any consequences? The answer would be no. That whatever compensation Richard receives will compensate him for his injury, but the injury to her will remain. There's another aspect of the Desitel case that justified it. What else? Yeah. Okay, so the conjectural nature of the damage. In fact, let me go back to number one here. Part of what the court talks about in terms of the indirect nature of the harm was it wasn't even clear when this first rule was first articulated that the wife had independent legal standing. that there was, at least in the origin of this rule, the idea that husband and wife were a single legal entity, as the expression goes, at common law, husband and wife were one and he was the one. And there is, in fact, a tradition going back at least as far as Blackstone, justifying a legal rule in which, in effect, husbands took various kinds of legal responsibilities and women didn't have an independent legal existence in the way that we take for granted. Okay, and again, to the extent that's out of sync with the structure of our legal system today, you would say, well, wait a minute, to the extent the rule relied upon, or the decision in Days and Tell relied upon that kind of thinking, it doesn't fit very well. Okay, so again, what about the conjectural nature of the damage? Okay, and what is that argument persuasive to the court? Right, going back to Steinhauser, you know, maybe men of science can't reach a conclusion about this, but it's a problem for which the jury is ideally suited. So juries can figure out what it's worth for Marianne to have lost this relationship with her husband or to have had it damaged in that way. Okay, point number three. Okay, again, this sort of floodgates argument that we're going to be faced with all of these, you know, spurious claims and so forth and so on. What's the court's answer to that? Right. Again, the idea is I could be lying through my teeth if I say I've suffered a whiplash injury, but that doesn't mean I'm barred from making a claim. If I file a complaint saying you hit me in a rear-end collision and I've been just in horrible physical pain ever since, the answer is let the jury figure it out. The engine of cross-examination and discovery and all these methods of separating who's telling the truth from who's not. What else? Not double jeopardy, but, yeah, double recovery, that we're compensating Marianne in addition to compensating Richard, are we essentially going to pay the same damages twice? And it's not a crazy argument from the standpoint that in many ways Richard's and Marianne's, to the extent she is saying that as part of this marriage, we did become one flesh, that his damages are my damages and my damages are his damages, and you're sort of in one of these infinite regress mirror situations where you keep seeing a reflection of a reflection of a reflection. Richard testifies about what it's like to go from being this active, vigorous guy to being requiring 24-hour nursing care and being confined to a wheelchair and so forth. And Richard talks about his sadness and grief and frustration in not being able to provide for his wife the kinds of things that as a husband he wanted to be able to do. And she in turn describes how sad and grieving she is that she has to watch this guy who was so much fun to be with, you know, now depressed and et cetera, et cetera. And then he describes how hard it is to watch her be depressed at how, you know, and we keep going kind of back and forth and they feed on each other in a way that, will we ever get to the end of this? What does the court say? As with other things, say the Pennsylvania wrongful death statutes, the jury has to make sure there isn't double recovery, but that's not a reason why we should give only one of these two, the the compensation that they deserve. Now, again, one of the difficulties in a case like this is to figure out what sort of public policy we are expressing when we adopt a rule like this. Do we really want to have every married person, in effect, having an additional claim, or for every plaintiff, or for every automobile accident victim, or product liability victim, or medical malpractice victim, every one of those who is married, there will automatically be a second plaintiff who is going to claim loss of consortium damages. It's most dramatic when a 600-pound pipe is dropped on somebody and they're put into a wheelchair, but does it have to be that dramatic? Virtually any physical injury is going to disrupt in some way the relationship in a marriage. Or will we have some kind of threshold to say, if all you suffered was a whiplash injury and you're on painkillers and you're in and out of work, well, that doesn't count. It has to be something like losing a limb or paralysis. That's the only kind of loss of consortium. Or do we basically say, gee, anytime someone's injured and they have a spouse, that spouse will predictably suffer from the injury to the relationship. My husband or my wife simply isn't what they were before the accident. They can't go fishing, so they're grumpy and they, you know, sit around the house and, whatever. Or do we want to have some kind of, again, some threshold that says not just any old injury generates a loss of consortium claim? It's got to be something really serious like Mary Ann's situation. The other problem is, as we'll see, how do we distinguish the loss of consortium claim in this case from the one in the next case, Borer versus American Airlines? Granted, there is a special status about the spousal relationship, but why isn't it equally compelling for the children in the Borer versus American Airlines case to say, when you dropped a light fixture on my mom, you dropped a light fixture on our family? Our mom was a fixture, so to speak, in this family dynamic. And so what's the distinction here? Is it because the spousal relationship is more fundamental than the parent-child relationship? Is it because the injury to Mary Ann, to Richard, was more dramatic than the one to Mrs. Borer? Is it because there are so many children involved? If you had a case in Borer that only involved one child, again, get your most sympathetic case. Get a single mom and a kid with special needs, where the injury to the mother had a particularly noticeable and devastating effect on the child. Would that have changed the court's mind in terms of saying we're going to treat this case as we did Richard and Mary Ann Rodriguez? So the dissenting opinion in Borer, as we'll talk about tomorrow, said in effect, gee, we just went through all these arguments in the Rodriguez case and demolished them one by one and said, no, that doesn't matter. No, that's not persuasive. That's a stupid reason not to give her recovery. And then all of a sudden in Borer, they're all rehabilitated and found persuasive. So, again, I guess the question I'd leave you with for tomorrow is, if you were writing an opinion for the California Supreme Court, or if you were in the legislature writing on a blank sheet of paper as to what the rules ought to be for these loss of consortium claims, who's going to qualify? And who will be told, in effect, I'm sorry? We'll pick that up tomorrow. Yeah.
We're only going up to chapter 3 on the midterm, is that right?
Yeah, right.
Are we going to start chapter 4 before
we probably will, yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.